Litcast Slovakia, the podcast about Slovak literature in English. Welcome to Litcast Slovakia. My name is Julia Sherwood. I'm a translator based in London. And for today's episode, I'll be joined by fellow translator John Minahane, who lives in Bratislava. John was born and educated in Ireland and worked there between 1971 and 1996 in a variety of occupations. He contributed to and sometimes edited several Irish literary journals, and he has lived and worked in Slovakia since 1996. From 1996 until 2013, he taught English, and since 2003, he has been translating into English, mainly literary, musicological, art historical, and ethnographic texts from Slovak, and more recently, also from Czech. Hello, John. Welcome to Litcast Slovakia.
Thanks, Julia. Glad to be here.
Thank you for coming, and I hope you're keeping safe and well in spite of the alarming rise in the level of coronavirus infections in Slovakia. Actually, the eyes of the world were on Slovakia last weekend when half of the nation was tested. How did it go?
For me, perfectly. I'm negative. And in general, I think it was very well organized, and it went like pretty well like clockwork.
Great. Well, we love to hear that. It's so rare to have good news these days. So you've done this in Slovakia, where you live, but you were born and bred in Ireland. And I'm intrigued. How did you wind up in Bratislava, and how did you get into translating?
Well, ending up in Bratislava was chance. I did want to go somewhere, but I hadn't been thinking of Slovakia. I was extremely unhappy in Ireland, and I wanted a complete change, a change of setting, a change of job, a change of acquaintances, a change of country. And one way to do that was to teach English as a foreign language. And first I'd been thinking of West European countries, but I found it wasn't that easy to get a job there if you didn't have experience. Whereas if you went a bit further east, it could be done. So I found a school that was prepared to take me in Bratislava. I came there and I liked it, so I stayed on. And I have literary interests, so in due course I began to read the local literature, and in due course I began translating some of it.
Over the years, you have translated many great Slovak poets, and I would like to start by asking you about Pavol Orsák Hviezdoslav's anti-war sonnet cycle, The Bloody Sonnets, which he composed in 1914. And in your introduction to the translation, which appeared in 2018, you say, "In all of the torrent of poetry that greeted the outbreak of the war, this may be the most powerful work from an anti-war perspective." An earlier translation of the cycle by Jaroslav Vajda appeared in 1972. So could you tell us why you felt that the Bloody Sonnets needed to be translated again?
Well, they were still practically unknown outside of Slovakia. The first people who should have known about them were the people who were writing general surveys of World War I literature, and they didn't. There are some quite good general surveys in English, but none of them mention the Bloody Sonnets. So that 1972 Bratislava edition didn't make the breakthrough. And nor did the American edition, where Jaroslav Vajda's translation was first published. It first appeared in Pennsylvania in 1950. Vajda himself, I think he did have literary talent, and his translation was often a help when I was struggling with the original Slovak text. But his English version, I think, has too much padding for the sake of rhyme. He was very over-ambitious in trying to copy the exact rhyming scheme that Vjazoslav had, which is the Petrarchan scheme, very, very difficult. And Vajda's translation, I think, doesn't read very well. But as it began to dawn on me myself how good, how powerful these sonnets were and how unique, when I realized that, I gradually started translating individual sonnets, and I was vaguely feeling I should do the whole lot. And the impulse came when a man I know, who's a curator in the Slovak National Gallery, he was doing one of these modern themed exhibitions, and his theme was blood. So he wanted the first bloody sonnet as an exhibit in Slovak and English, and he asked me to do the English version. And when I had done that, it kind of launched me. Over the next 3 or 4 years after that, I did the whole lot.
And the rest is history. So the Bloody Sonnets are a seminal work of Slovak literature. Every child is required to read it at school, but because of its difficult idiosyncratic language, very few really understand it. And I have a suspicion that not many return to it in later life. And I have to confess that I didn't really understand it myself until I read your English version, which suddenly brought it to life for me. So I imagine that translating it must have posed a huge challenge. Can you talk a little about what it was like translating the grandfather of Slovak literature?
Well, I was tuned into the thoughts, and that was key. I was determined not to be defeated by the language difficulties, but I'm not going to pretend that those weren't big. There was plenty of difficulty, yes. And there's one particular practice Fyacislav had, which makes him very daunting, and that is he shortens ordinary Slovak words so as to lose a syllable. He does that very often because he felt Slovak had too many long words and they were unpoetic, they were cumbersome, and this was something he really admired English for, that the English language was so lean and compact and concise. And he wanted his Slovak to be lean and concise as much as possible. So as a result, he radically shortened things. And in the Bloody Sonnets, for example, one writer calculated the average number of syllables per word in the Bloody Sonnets. And he reckoned it was less than the usual syllabic average for Slovak by about a quarter, which is a huge reduction. So I think the result of all this word shortening is that many Slovaks, and this includes professional literary people I've spoken to, they're convinced that Fyacislav actually invented new words. And he absolutely denied that he did anything of the kind, and I believe him. But I think if he had done all this as an official, committed avant-gardist, something in the spirit of Velimir Klebnikov, if he'd published a manifesto saying, I don't like the usual language we have and I'm going to have my own, if he'd done that, I think maybe all the critics today would admire him for it. But he wasn't, in fact, avant-gardist. He was just a highly ambitious poet who was trying to solve all the literary problems that he was confronted with in his own way. And I must say, I admire him for what he tried to do with the language, even if maybe I'm the only one, and even if he made me suffer for it.
Well, the result is definitely worth that suffering.
Thanks.
And I think plenty of readers will be very, very grateful to you. So apart from Hvězdoslav, you have also translated many great Slovak poets of the post-war generation, such as Ladislav Novomeský, Miroslav Válek and Milan Rufus. Can you briefly introduce our listeners to these three poets?
Novomeský is the one that I feel closest to. He was somebody who lived many kinds of lives. He was first of all a poet. He was active as a poet from the 1920s to the 1970s. But he was also active as a journalist, a Communist Party member, an anti-Nazi rebel in the Slovak National Uprising in 1944. After that, he was a government minister for some years. Then he was condemned as a traitor. He escaped very narrowly with his life, could easily have been executed. He was a political prisoner for 5 years after that. Then afterwards he was a blacklisted person. And finally, he was an active contributor to the movement called the Prague Spring. But his poetry wasn't propagandist. It wasn't, certainly wasn't the socialist realist kind of newspaper poetry. He was melancholic as a poet, very lyrical, very musical. He always had a tragic idea of poetry, and of course his life gave him plenty of tragedies, multiple tragedies. Like many people at that time, he put his hopes in the future, that there would be a future when poetry would be more appreciated and when people would be more human. And he expressed this in one short poem, which I'd like to quote, just 8 lines. It was a motto to a collection that he produced in 1939, that ominous year. And it goes, "When poetry is read again, and men the aspect of men show, when muddy waters melt and drain, the springtime frost and autumn snow, that time of bullets, blades, and screams, how wretched it was, we'll say then, when worthless were the poet's dreams and man to man was alien." Now,
thank you, that was lovely.
Thanks. Valak interests me, but I've translated very little of him. He also became a government minister. He ended up as Minister for Culture. And as a poet, he wrote, I think, in many different styles. Some of it was Communist Party propaganda. Some of it was children's verse. He wrote some very, very singable love poems, which have been recorded by singers like Miroslav Shpirka. And he also wrote some quite ferocious existential poems, the kind of poems that make you think of what Jean-Paul Sartre said, that hell is other people. Maybe I'm misinterpreting them, but that's the kind of take I have on them. A selection of his work came out in English about 25 years ago, translated, I think, very well by Ewald Ozers, called The Ground Beneath Our Feet. Milan Rufus, I suppose you could call him the elegist, the great elegist of Slovak country life, the old country life that wasn't very mechanized. In Rufus's poems, you don't usually find tractors or combined harvesters. You find horses, and you find basic tools, basic manual tools, and basic manual labor, and a lot of skilled manual labor, and a whole way of living and thinking that went with this. Now, I myself saw the tail end of this kind of country life in Ireland in my childhood, because I grew up in a rural community, and for the first few years of my life, there weren't any combined harvesters or milking machines in the community, and many small farmers didn't even have tractors. They still used horses. But then when I was 7 or 8 years old, mechanization came in like an avalanche. And Seamus Heaney, the Irish poet who got the Nobel Prize, he also writes about this kind of life. But with Heaney, I think it's basically nostalgia, whereas with Rufus, it's more than that, it's tragedy. Rufus feels that there is some kind of irreparable loss. There's something. Something there that we can that we have lost and can never replace or recover.
Well, thank you for these wonderful and poignant vignettes of those three great poets. This summer, you spent a month on a residency in Zbanská Štiavnica, working on the collection Fragment Rytierského lesa, Fragment of a Knight's Forest by Ivan Štrbka. Štrbka is one of the most acclaimed and respected Slovak poets writing today, and yet, apart from a few poems in anthologies, very little of his work has appeared in English. For those of our listeners who are not familiar with Štrbka's work, Can you say a few words about his poetry and what, for you, makes it stand out?
I think he has a private or personal, very personal language, which isn't completely private. It's not just solipsist. It's connected with the world that isn't private. And the relationship is very highly charged and very interesting for me. The way his poetry was explained to me by one of the literary critics was that it was a kind of second order reaction against the socialist realism, which was basically socialist realism was putting the newspapers in verse, putting rhyme and meter on the kind of thoughts that you got in the currently in the newspapers. Then you had a concretist reaction against that. People were saying you don't have to be absolutely shouting all the time. You can give a broader account of the world in poetry, but it still will be a realist. It still will be concrete. And then there was a further reaction against that, saying, why does it have to be concrete? Why can we not have personal languages? And that is where I think Štyrbka was launched. He sought to have a personal language, and part of this language involved images from past times, quite far in the past, like the knight is an important image for Štyrbka. Or the Lancer. His first collection was called A Brief History of Lancers. The collection that I am that I translated, once again, the knight is an important figure here, and it's the knight. It's the story of Percival, the boy who was brought up in a forest. He was the son of a knight, but his mother wanted to protect him from the horrors of war. But when he became an adolescent, he felt the need to go out into the world and to be a knight. And he came with his own kind of mind. He confronted the strange world out there quite uncompromisingly with his own way of thinking and doing things. That's the story of Percival, and it runs through this this collection that I've just translated. I'll give an example briefly, if I may. The very first poem, called Battlefields, Plains, it begins with somebody going through a completely alien landscape. There's really scarcely anything you can relate to in it, or that this person can relate to. As he says himself, it's under a murky sky without sign of connection. There's no connection there. But suddenly he makes the connection from memory. A memory comes to him, and it's one of my memories also. It's this moment when you're a boy, you're on a football field, and you see the ball coming from a distance towards you. It's getting bigger and bigger. It's coming at mighty speed, and it's coming right towards you. It's destined for you, and you have to kick this ball, and you have to do it right. And it feels like it will be absolute disaster if you do it wrong, that you feel like you're going to die if you don't do this properly. And how Štyrbka renders this moment is as follows. A lightning bolt memory for a split second makes my knees founder, sends me back to that boyhood moment when suddenly I tensed rigid at the extreme of peripheral vision and spanning out gaze, shortly before the touch, a second before I ought to slam a precise kick on the increasing ball, which giddily fast, addressed unerringly, with a joyous, slight subdued swishing in full glory, was borne to me like a bomb blast on the trembling air of the pitch and battlefield. What you don't strike well may easily kill you. And he goes on from there to extend the image to the real battlefield, or the battlefield of life, And he expresses a prayer: "Rescue me amid this great moment, which endures and falls on me constantly. The moment never dies." I think that is it's anything but an original theme. Boys of all generations have had this kind of experience, but Stjupka addresses it quite perfectly freshly with his own, with his private language, and at the same time in a way that that somebody from the outside can tune in. That's what I feel about him, that he can express very well-known moments absolutely freshly and memorably.
Well, this example that you read certainly brings it to life. I loved slight subdued swishing. It's wonderful.
Yeah, he relaxes. There's a kind of relaxation in the moment which he catches. That was wonderful.
So we've been talking about poetry, and let's move on to prose now. In 2014, your translation of a modern classic from 1940 was published by the Central European Press in Budapest, Tri Gasztanowe Konie, Three Chestnut Horses by Margita Figuli. How did this translation come about, and why did the publishing house choose this particular book, and what kind of reader do you think it would appeal to?
Well, the publishing house was doing classic novels from all of the former Warsaw Pact countries, and they wanted to have one from Slovakia. I presume that the Center for Information on Literature probably suggested, it's possible that they suggested that one to them. It is a novel, after all, which is regarded as one of the classics. It's always been in print. I don't know what kind of reader it would ha it was aimed at. Really, it's a strange story, but it's quite in many ways it's a very good novel. The pace, it's well paced. The writing is quite economical, while at the same time being vivid. But it's a really strange story. It's a kind of Christian love story, and at a crucial moment in the story, the hero does something absolutely unromantic. He refuses to take his love away from a very, very dangerous and unpleasant situation because he fears it might dishonor her. And twice he does this. And of course, she suffers terribly. She has frightful disasters in the situation thereafter. But she accepts this as a Christian, and so in some fashion does he. And the story ends, there's a happy ending. I mentioned that it was a Christian story. It was afterwards, of course, it was afterwards refashioned to be a communist love story. But it's always, I think, been in print from about 1940 until now.
Well, let's hope it'll find some English readers as well. And now I'd like to turn to two contemporary authors who have written both poetry and fiction and who don't fit very neatly into any pigeonholes, Ivan Kolenich and Peter Maczewski. So let's start with Kolenich. You have translated excerpts from his novel Daj s Bohom básnieniu, Say Goodbye to Poetry, of which you've said that Kolenich resurrects the accursed poet with unpredictable humor as well as imaginative energy. So can you elaborate on this a little bit, please?
I think It's very difficult to give an impression of Kolinich without quoting him. I know I've been quoting a lot during this, but at least one more. I want to give you one sentence from
Yes,
Kolinich.
please, please go. Please go ahead. I actually feel sorry that in the previous podcasts we didn't really have enough quotes, so this is great.
Okay, well, this. I promise you, this sentence will actually end. It will eventually end. It's the first sentence, I think it's the first sentence from Say Goodbye to Poetry. The accursed poet, I should say, generally has a girlfriend, and not necessarily just one, but he has a chief girlfriend. She sometimes is trying to save him from himself. But sometimes she is as wild as he is, and she's enjoying him not saving himself. And this is the case in the present extract, a woman called Clarica. She told me she loved me as a verse-creating object, as something with an enormous shaggy tail, something absurdly spectacular, and at the same time hopelessly primitive, old-fashioned, prehistoric. I love you as a most magnificently versifying object, Clarica would murmur through kiss-curved lips before everyone had fallen asleep and let nothingness alight upon the earth till then unended. I love you as an object of poetry, as a swarm of animate corpuscles, as a race of irredeemable tramps. While all were not yet sleeping, Clarica was in her element. She raved into the blue sky like a crossed-out conscience. She spat out her ice cream over bastards and roared laughing. She did handstands and cartwheels. She stripped off her t-shirt in the public squares, ripping the hearts out of old men. She was splendid and beautiful. She would dream with open eyes of inaugurating the reign of folly, then immediately fall into gloom and vicious cursing. The chaff to death, the cornucopia for life. So, that's
Wow,
Kolinich.
this was all one
This is one
sentence.
sentence, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. And now, Peter Maczewski, who not only writes both poetry and fiction, but he has also published in both Slovak and Hungarian, which I think is quite unique. Now, your translation of an excerpt from his novel Mykać Kostliusami, Making Skeletons Dance, really captured the spirit and energy of this extraordinary book, which I dearly wish would find an English language readership. So, how would you pitch this novel to a publisher?
I suppose I'd say this is one of the best psychological novels you can find around. As far as plot goes, it's basically somebody sitting in a pub in Amsterdam or sitting in a series of pubs in Amsterdam, and that doesn't sound too exciting, but he's thinking about his life, he's thinking about his past, his present, thinking also about other countries, and he is a foreigner, which is important. He is experiencing life as a foreigner in Amsterdam very richly. And Machovsky goes to the limit on things like that. The character says things like, anybody who cherishes tenderness for his native language must be an idiot. An idiot! A dangerous idiot. The language where you most perfectly understand the hatred and the insults. And that is typical of the kind of throwaway jewels in this book. It's full of it has many different kinds of writing. It has some wonderful monologues, one of which you have translated yourself, where his mother, the main character's mother, warns him about ending up as the slave of a woman. And at the end of this monologue, where he vainly tries to break in a few times and she just talks him down, at the end of it, he has this insight that yes, he is the slave of a woman, the woman he's just been talking to. And The book is the book is full of interesting things. The image of making skeletons dance is from Mexico, from the Mexican Dance of the Dead, and you can take the Dance of the Dead as a kind of philosophy of life, that we're dancing skeletons or we're making other skeletons dance, but anything like will and purpose doesn't have much reality. That's more or less the philosophy of the main character, but he expresses it very, very richly and interestingly. And the book, as a psychological novel, it's really one of the most interesting things I've come across in recent times.
Well, let's hope that a publisher somewhere out there is listening to our podcast and will decide to publish this book. Yeah. And are there any other Slovak authors or books you think should be published in English and that you would like to translate really very briefly, because I think we've already been talking for over half an hour.
Oh, right. I would like to translate Jan Smerik sometime. I think he's a marvelous poet at his best. He's one of the older ones, post-World War I, Nova Meskis generation, but very fine celebrant of wine, women, song, music, and all good things. I'd like to do that sometime. There are prose writers about, maybe František Švantner, maybe some of his novellas, some of his, because his longer novels are very long. Maybe sometime some of those.
Finally, can you tell us what you are working on now?
Well, I am working on various things. One is I am working slowly on a collection by Erik Ondrejczyk, who is one of the, I suppose, middle generation poets. His first collections came out in 2000, and he's interesting in that many of his poems are rhymed. He most writers now use free verse, but Ondrejczyk uses rhymes, and they're not mechanical. They're always fresh and lively. Otherwise, he's one of the Buddhist poets of Bratislava, but he also has a whole lot of more European melancholy that conflicts or coexists with the Buddhism. I find his poetry interesting, and I'm working now on a translation, on a collection.
Well, I look forward to seeing this, and also to some of the translations of poetry that will appear in the Tupelo Quarterly. It will be the second part of a selection of a feature on Slovak poetry that they're going to publish. It's coming out later this year, and next week I'll be talking to the editor of this feature, Lucia Duero. But in the meantime, thank you very much for this really, really lovely, lively and enlightening conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Julie.
You.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.